It's very nice to see some snow. In Toronto, it's not very nice.
You don't have the snow yet?
It's and it goes away very quickly. So this is very pretty. So I'm happy with that.
Are you
Okay.
mocking us?
The snow is always whiter, I don't know. Okay, so I want to highlight the graduate students at CETA that are working on this, in particular George Stein, and my other collaborators, Dick Bond and Nick Battaglia, who's at Princeton now, and Anita Bamanyar. And George has made a lot of the recent plots that I'll show towards the end, some exciting new results that we just got basically yesterday. So let me go on now to the outline. So this talk is about making mocks. These are simulations of large-scale structure meant to be compared to observations. The idea is that they're on very large scales. It's a sort of top-down approach that we're taking. I'm trying to model the longest wavelength modes of fluctuations in large-scale structure, in anticipation of surveys and existing observations, and then populate it with increasing levels of sophistication and modeling to put the objects in. So whereas you might do an adaptive mesh resolution simulation of a galaxy, and for that one object compare it to simulations, what this talk is going to be over is the top-down, the opposite. So I'll give the motivation, the way we are approaching the problem. I'll talk about some results on halo clustering. The halos being the places where the galaxies form, and if you can understand dark matter halo formation and the statistics of how halos cluster in space, that will get you, for a given cosmological model, that will get you a long way. So I'll spend some time on that. Then I'll talk about the most recent things that we hopefully will have a paper out on soon, which is doing a large ensemble of mock simulations of full sky simulations of the cluster Sunyaev-Zel'dovich effect, which I'll get into, and then summary. So that should have been the motivation. So this is the motivation. So, and I separated into these two sort of separate categories: data analysis and theory. So, and this is I kind of think of it when I approach the problem. Sometimes I think of it in terms of data analysis, where you're just doing a simulation. You already know sort of the physics that you want to put in, and you just want to get the statistical correlations in order so that a large survey can get the covariance matrix, so that it can get the, on and on. And so sometimes I think, oh, this is really, why am I doing this? So boring. But it's very important, and it's actually tied to the more fun problems, which are, why do halos cluster the way they do? How does structure form? The more sort of theoretical questions. And obviously, they're all linked up. So the data analysis, this is so motivations, this Hyper Supreme CAM at Subaru.
I think your MPI is the other way around. The theory part is the boring
Is the boring
part.
part?
Data analysis.
So again, the grass is always greener. Okay. So then dark energy survey, LSST, Euclid, these are these large surveys that are going to either spectroscopic, photometric, getting many, many thousands, hundred thousands, millions of galaxies and clusters of galaxies, mapping out the observable universe in a huge order of magnitude gain in the volume probed and the number of modes. This is a big motivation. Galaxy surveys, cosmic microwave background, it's still not over. There's more to be done. That's more than just B modes. There are secondary anisotropies that come from reionization, which is tracing the very first galaxies that affects the cosmic microwave background. There's lensing of the cosmic microwave background. And what I'm talking about today is Sunyaev-Zel'dovich effect, which is electron scattering. And all of this can be correlated with that because it's the same universe and the cosmic microwave background has to travel through the same objects that are being seen in these surveys. And then a whole new thing, which I'm sure many of you had heard of, which is intensity mapping, which is a way to basically do galaxy surveys without looking at the individual objects. So there is a lot of motivation for all this data analysis to have, to be able to simulate the data, get so that you know that what you put in is what you get out, basically. So what are the simulations as far, what are the challenges as far as the simulations go? As always, it's speed and dynamic range. So we have some region. I'll just go over this very quickly. This is pretty elementary. But I just want to say that you have a flux limit. So if you have a survey and you say, okay, my survey is going to look at the sky for this long and it's going to look at objects going down to this faint level of flux. That in our language would correspond to a dark matter halo of a given mass. So if you do a simulation and you want to resolve a dark matter of given mass, that's your flux limit, that's your mass resolution. Then of course you have your survey volume, which is generally way bigger than that. And so this is just to give an idea of the scaling. So if you want to resolve galaxy mass halos, and you want to do it approaching 10 gigaparsecs, that's sort of our volume, you would need 16,000 cubed particles. So we don't do that, or some people do, but you only do it once or twice. So how do you get around that? Well, you can make smaller boxes, do an ensemble, you can be smart about it, et cetera, et cetera. But if you could just wave your hand and do it, this is what you would just have. So right, so the other is that our patch that we observe is in principle a part of an ensemble of other patches, or if you want to think of it that way, or we're looking at one realization of some random process. So there is cosmic variance. So in principle, you don't just want to do one of them, you want to do a lot of those 16,000 cube things in order to understand what the statistics are. Fine, okay, so that was a sort of data analysis and what our challenges are. Then we have the more theoretical questions. So there's perturbation theory, and in this I sort of include the sort of a field theory of effective field theory of structure. And then where the idea is that you have a power spectrum. You have some characterization of the fluctuations. And what you're trying to do is you're trying to develop a mathematical formalism approach for doing this analytically, okay, for predicting for a given cosmological models how the initial Gaussian fluctuations evolve and become the observed spectrum of fluctuations and higher order statistics of that. That is generally perturbative. Or you try to hide the hot component in some effective component, some subgrid sort of thing. But there is the hot component. What I mean by hot component is you have these sort of modes that are gently collapsing and biasing themselves, but then you have these objects that have collapsed, which are the halos, and they thermally relax into these equilibrium structures. This is a very important part of it, that this part doesn't always or often does not approach. So I'm going to be talking a lot about halos here. So, and what you want to probe, and the way I've put it here is delta lin, that's the density fluctuations at some early time. That would correspond to potential fluctuations or curvature perturbations, which would tell you about the very initial conditions. The growth factor, the linear growth factor, d of redshift z, this tells you how fast perturbations grow in time, which depends now not on the initial state, but how gravity works, how the universe is evolving. And then, of course, the expansion history of the universe itself, apart from the growth of the fluctuations, just on average, how quickly are things going apart. So let me talk about the way we're doing this. So we are generating catalogs of halos. So everything in that you're going to see here is all based on halo catalogs that we generate. In other words, all the gas of filaments and things between halos is not in here. However, by passing that up, we get to focus on these sort of scaffolding and the places where the galaxies are and where most of the action is. And so what we do is we talk about Lagrangian exclusion and peak dynamics. Halos form at the peaks of the initial density field, and halos of given scales form at peaks on those different scales. And then when they form, when an object collapses out of the background, you can't have two objects collapsing from the same region, obviously. So we call it Lagrangian exclusion. And this is something that as you try to push towards smaller and smaller scales, this is becoming very important in the clustering of objects. So the idea is you have some number of modes that are accessible. As the modes get smaller, you have more and more of those modes, but they're more and more difficult to model. So a key part of modeling those smaller nonlinear modes is this idea of exclusion. And by Lagrangian in this context means in the initial space, things move, but you can move them back to their Lagrangian. It's like Lagrangian versus Eulerian. So let me jump right into it. So what I'm describing here is our algorithm for generating these mocks. It's based on something called peak patches, which was developed in the 90s by Bond and Myers. And what it is a way to sidestep doing n-body simulations. So when you do an n-body simulation, as many of you know, you generate an initial density field, and then you put down particles and you displace them according to that random realization, and then you let it go and they move according to gravity, or if you have more sophisticated. And then as they move, you get some end state. It's sort of a black box. You look, you find the halos later, and you know, oftentimes you just extract a halo catalog. What this is a way to do that without doing the simulation. And the point being that you find peaks, because you know the great thing about large-scale structure is this, is that the thing you observe now is faithful to the initial state. It's not turbulent, it didn't get all mixed up. So if I see a halo there, I know that it corresponded to a peak in the initial space. So we use that, and that was their insight. And what I'll be talking about today, this is the version of it. So what you do is you generate a random field, and then you take a hierarchy of scales, because structure forms at all scales. So you have to sort of look at it at different scales. Each scale, you smooth the field, okay? And then for each place, yeah.
Different decays in mass, or different, like, private, separate?
Right now, we're doing them logarithmically spaced, and we do convergent studies to see how close the scales have to be.
How close are they?
In radius, 10%.
In radius?
1.1.
Has this approach been validated by
yes,
through
also.
The n-body with initial condition?
Yes.
You're bypassing and you get the same answer?
Yeah. And you can judge when I show it how good. It's not perfect. Right, okay. So yes, you smooth, and then if you find it's a peak, which is very easy to do, you just look at the first and second derivatives, you add it to this list of candidate objects. And then you just do this, and you find all these candidate peaks on all these scales, and you put them in a list. Now you go back, and for each peak, you're gonna do a detailed measurement. And the detailed measurement will involve looking at the density, the linear density of the field, as a function of radius in spheres outward from each of these candidate points. And you will also look at the linear strain, which is there are linear displacements, and then there are the derivatives of the linear displacements. And basically, you can always diagonalize that into something which looks like an ellipsoid. So it's a sphere. At each scale you measure in a sphere, you measure the density in the sphere, and you measure two other things, which are the prolificity and the ellipticity of this linear displacement field. So it's all in the initial condition space, in the linear space, but you make these three measurements, and you make them at different scales. Then, and this was what Bond and Myers did, you replace this thing. Some of you may have heard of spherical collapse, the top hat model. This is a generalization of the top hat model, which replaces the sphere with something that's going to become an ellipsoid. So now it has three axes. And you solve, assuming the ellipsoid stays homogeneous, you solve for the collapse of the ellipsoid in the presence of a tidal field, which is given by this linear strain. And in linear theory, if you measure the tidal field inside of an object, if you measure the strain inside of an object, you've measured the linear tidal field already. You don't have to go outside of it. That's just how it works. So that's a differential equation in three axes. So you know, when you do a spherical collapse, you have one axis, the radius, and it gets larger, and then it collapses, and that's the spherical collapse model. And this one, there's three. So the one collapses, the other collapses. I don't want to get too technical, but you wait till that whole ellipsoid thing sort of collapses down to, you say it collapses, and then you say, okay, that's a halo. And then you gather all of them. You ask, at what radius is the ellipsoid would just be collapsing now? And that's what's the largest radius? And then I'd say, okay, I've identified a peak with a region that will collapse around it. And then you have a bunch of them.
So I guess at different scales, you would find different peaks. So how do you know whether they are the same peaks or different ones?
Exactly. So I didn't put it here. Well, it's the merging process. So you can easily find on one scale a peak, and then on the next scale, another peak right next to it that overlaps almost completely with it. And that's why there's this next step. So that is, I'll skip this part. I'll just briefly mention that there's a whole art to the realization of the field. But generally, the things I'll be showing today will be your typical periodic box, where you have a lattice that's uniform, and you make a Gaussian random field with some power spectrum, which is from the cosmology. So here's this is what I sort of talked about in detail, and then this is what I should be getting to, which is the overlap. And then in the second part where I talk about the SZ, the cluster maps, of the mocks that we make, then we take that thing and we project it into a map with some model for the. Okay, right. So this is sort of the whole flow. And then you do it. And then you just do it over and over again. And you generate a bunch of catalogs, each one with a different sort of random seed. So here's the comparison to N-body. So what we did is, we've done several of these boxes, 512 cubed N-body simulation, very standard. For those of you that do N-body, it's 512 megaparsecs. And it's some width, something like 10 megaparsecs in this direction width. And you run the N-body, you do the halo finder, and we show them here. And we put circles, which are basically the size of their virial radii, R200, if you will. 200 times the mean density. And then we do the same thing. So here's the agreement. Switch back and forth. This is before we've made the latest round of corrections, which I think is going to make it a lot better, which have to do with when you have this ellipsoid, when the first axis collapses, you don't let it collapse to when the first axis collapses, you don't let it collapse to a pancake. You stop it. And then you let the other one collapse into a cigar, and then finally you let the other one collapse in the differential equation. But you have a choice as to when you stop it. And what we were finding was we were stopping it too soon. So there are some free parameters in it. One is the spacing between these scales, this 1.1. And the other is, but that's something you can converge on. This one is really, you know, because you're approximating a very complicated situation by ellipsoids, but they're better than spheres. So here they are on top of each other. You have the largest objects show quite good agreement. You can pick out some where you can't even see the other one because it's below it. There are some objects that are just like, what is that? Usually they're the smallest ones, so you're sort of, it's a resolution question of resolution. The other thing I didn't mention is that once you identify, this whole process happened in what we call the Lagrangian space. That is to say that you just look at its initial co-moving position before it moved, but structure forms, things move. And so we use first order linear perturbation theory, or the Zeldovich approximation. We measure the mean displacement in this thing, and then we move it according to that. And it turns out that it works quite well. In other words, halos, when they collapse, all the nonlinear things that are not addressed by first order linear Lagrangian perturbation theory, or linear perturbation theory, happen in the collapse, which we're addressing with this highly nonlinear homogeneous ellipsoid, but this whole thing moves, participating in a linear flow. And we've checked versus second order Lagrangian perturbation theory, it's not too different. So that's an interesting thing we want to follow up on more. Yeah.
So it looks like that the middle is when there is a huge direct circle.
Yes.
And
there is
associated blue circle.
There is. It's below. Oh, I can switch.
Below?
You're talking about that big one, right?
Yeah. Oh, okay. So they're just on top of each other.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Okay. That's very good.
Good. I'm glad. Sometimes people are like, why? And I'm like, this is a thousand times faster.
But Marcelo, I just have a question. So
yeah.
So you mentioned that you don't have to worry about turbulence or hardly complex linear phenomena.
Yes.
Because you see that it doesn't happen with these embodied approximations. But then why can I not push back and say, well, maybe you weren't resolving it to see that it actually happens?
Oh, absolutely. So yes. In sort of effective field theories, if you think about perturbation theory, there's always, you can imagine that there's this high energy that you're marginalizing over, which is, so there's a separation of scales. So in the each one of these representing a galaxy, there will be satellites, all these nonlinear structures, there will be tidal stripping of smaller things. And so not only do we worry about it, but we know that that's there. But the nice thing is, again, with this, the mixing of scales is not as bad as you would get with turbulence. Things go nonlinear. There's a clear nonlinear scale. And as time goes by, that nonlinear scale gets larger and larger in cold dark matter. So, but yes, that is the top down I was talking about. And that is where we say, well, okay, we're going to by hand go in, and in every 10 to the 12 solar mass halo, we're going to put something in there that looks like the Milky Way because we know that it looks that way, not because we simulate it, something like that. This is the cross correlation. So if you just take each of those objects and just throw them down on a mesh as delta functions, and then you do the correlation. Sorry, this is not the cross correlation. Oh, okay, there's the cross correlate. So this, so focus on peaks versus peaks is the solid line. That is the power spectrum of the halos in our peaks simulation. The dashed line is the power spectrum in the n-body. And then the dashed, or the dotted, is the cross correlation. And so, as you saw in the picture, they're basically look similar to each other, and this just shows it in a bit more detail. And then
gadget halos.
That's right. And here there's a cross correlation coefficient, which is just the cross correlation divided by the square root of the product of the other two. If it's one, they're perfectly correlated. So it just shows that over a range of scales, this is a two-point correlation function. And just to give you an idea, the resolution scale, it's a 512 megaparsec box with 512 cubed particles, so the resolution is 1 megaparsec. So the resolution is here. By the time you get up here, you have on average 5 cubed particles, or 100 particles. So these halos here, separated on these small scales, are 100 particles, something like that.
But if I think of an embodied, so the n-body simulations convergence rate is 1 over the square root of the number of particles. So the difference between 250,000 and 150,000 is 29%.
Ah, yes.
This is not a very stringent convergence plot.
I unfortunately failed to mention what this is. This is the number of objects. So when you saw the plot with all the objects in it, we took the most massive n objects. So sorry about that. So in the blue line, it's the most massive 5,000 objects. And the most massive things are most highly biased. And so that's why these are more strongly clustered. The more massive things cluster more strongly together than the less massive things, which tend to be everywhere rather than concentrated. And so that's what that shows. So sorry, I don't have a convergence plot on that, but thanks for pointing that out.
Because
yes, it's the same, 512 cubed. And they both have the same resolution in that sense. They have the same number of resolution elements. Okay, let's see. So I have 25 minutes.
Yeah. So could I say that, I guess, below 5 megaparsec, then the correspondence kind of breaks down?
Yeah.
Because the cross-correlation.
Yeah, it starts, gets greater than 1, and it does start to break down. So if I were showing you a power spectrum, you could start to think of it in terms of a K nonlinear. That's something we want to do, to put it on the footing of perturbation theory. Of course, we don't have the matter, we just have points. That's separate. So now that I hopefully have shown you that it's pretty good, it's about, as I say, 100 to 1,000 times faster than doing the n-body, I will just show some results that look at that same function I showed, the two-point correlation function, just in more detail. And this is a bit more talking about the theory of halo collapse. In particular, what I'm going to be talking about is because we find the objects in their sort of initial Lagrangian space, we can ask what their clustering is like in that space versus what's their clustering like in the final space. The point is that if you have some long wavelength mode in the early universe, at the peak of the long wavelengths, you will form more objects, and that's a biasing effect. And that's just because it's slightly higher in density, and so things get a boost, and that's a bias. But then there's also another effect, which is what we call the Eulerian bias, which is that everything ends up moving towards that peak as well, separately from that they were boosted, and that's an Eulerian bias. So what I'm going to be showing is those two different kinds of biases. So these are just about how long it takes. So these 1024 cubed, 3 minutes, 64 cores, et cetera, et cetera. And we did 400 of them, which allows us to build up some statistics on the correlation function. I might skip over the covariance. So again, this Lagrangian versus Eulerian clustering. So this is Eulerian. This is, I think, the same plot that I showed you before. So I basically, that same comparison, I didn't do the n-body, but I did, you know, 500 more of the other ones. And what this is exactly what I said earlier. I can go back to the Lagrangian positions, easy. Actually, you had to calculate those and then move them. And so you see a bias here. You still see that clustering pattern, but it doesn't jump out at you the way it used to. So you're actually separating out these two effects. Another thing you see here, which is quite interesting, is exclusion, the idea that this guy doesn't have anything else inside of it. And now, actually, I'm showing the virial radii, but before it collapsed, like the region in Lagrangian space that it collapsed out of is larger. So what you actually see here, and it's complicated by the fact that it's a projection, but you do see fewer objects here than you would think. You see a kind of a ring. And this is this effect of exclusion. And this is very important when you want to push down to these small scales and really try to get, you know, because the more smaller scales you can go, the more information you can extract out of a survey. This shows the... Yeah, this shows the Lagrangian radii, this large radius that it collapses to. This is just the more massive ones, because if I showed all of them, it would be even more complicated when I did that. They are overlapping because of projection effects. So we tried to make this smaller, but then we only had it was very difficult to visualize this. I could show it a 3D one.
Actually, the radius is just rescaled.
No, they are heavily overlapping here. I wasn't looking properly. Then they're clipped. This is before the merging. Yeah, sorry. That's right. So here you see all those little things basically are gotten rid of, and some projection effects. So now we saw the pictures of Eulerian versus Lagrangian. Now we can look at the actual correlation function. And so this here again is this number, and this is a cut. So these are the 100,000 most massive objects in the box. Then the 5,000, 50,000, and so on. And notice, this is the correlation function. This is the baryon acoustic oscillation, which would measure dark energy. And notice that as you cut towards higher and higher masses and this number goes down, the clustering gets larger and larger. Okay, that's because more massive things are more biased. So you get up to 500. And also note that these are 1 and 2 sigma from a bunch of simulations, so any given simulation will. And what you see is that as you go towards fewer objects, it gets rattier. Okay. Now this is Eulerian versus Lagrangian. So now we go back and we say, we're going to look at 100,000, a large fraction of the halos in the box. But then we're going to look at them in Lagrangian space. And now you see that the clustering is almost gone. That is because the intrinsic Lagrangian bias of this set of objects is really quite low. And all of that you saw is due to the Eulerian movement, this Zeldovich approximation that just moves things. And what I want to show here is, so now I'm just doing this Lagrangian Eulerian for different number cuts. So let's look at this 10,000 one. And notice now that these things have become on small scales anti-correlated in Lagrangian space, and that's because they can't be that close to each other. So once you approach the scale of the object, you get exclusion. And it just gets more pronounced. And these are the correlation functions, and you can actually see. So this is the covariant structure of that object. So you ask, how is one bin correlated with the other? Because in a given realization, if you happen to have a long wavelength mode, it will boost everything sort of on some. This was 500 for this one. And so here is the diagonal. Here's your covariant structure. That's just the variance that you saw. But then you see this very interesting effect of the exclusion down here at these small scales, at 5 megaparsec scales. So this was a proof of concept that this should give helpful insight when analyzing actual galaxy surveys.
Isn't it surprising that there's so little correlation? Because this is a real space correlation function.
It is a real space correlation function. So this is for 2000. Right.
In real space, I mean, everything is correlated with something hold up. So it's a bit surprising that they cross.
Yeah, but that's why I say 2,000, right? So with 2,000, it's fewer objects. Yeah. So their mean separation is quite large. So that could be
maybe
it.
Maybe it's just a Poisson.
Yeah. Yes, yes. And so as you go to more objects, right, you go further off the diagonal. But yeah, I haven't. That's an interesting question. Oops, which way am I going? Okay, so in my time remaining, I will talk now about the full mock. So what was shown there was sort of an intermediate step where you're looking at halos and so on, but we didn't think of a given survey with a given flux, and we didn't try to match it to Sloan or something like that. So this is the first part of this where we're trying to match to doing mock of an actual observation. And that actual observation is the Planck full sky Compton parameter map, which I'll talk about, which is from galaxy clusters. So the first thing to say is that what happens that creates the effect that we are simulating is that hot electrons in galaxy clusters, Thomson scatter, the microwave background, they're very hot, 1,000,000 degrees Kelvin. They have a thermal distribution, and when they scatter, they inverse Compton scatter, and they distort the spectrum away from a black body. It's called a Y-type distortion that was first talked about by Sunyav and Zeldovich, hence the Sunyav-Zeldovich. And it creates a distortion away from a black body. So if you have Planck maps of the sky at different frequency bands, the way that they get the CMB, the primary, is they fit black bodies to everywhere. And then there's the foregrounds. And part of these foregrounds are these distortions that are created in the direction of galaxy clusters, galaxy groups as well. So the reason it's the cluster Sunyav-Zeldovich effect is you need hot electrons. And so I'll talk about that a bit more, which the more massive the object is, the hotter. So this is the CMB. So what's happening here? I'm going to be talking about mocks that do, this is a two-dimensional section of our sort of light cone. So this is as we see back. This is in co-moving coordinates. So out here is the last scattering surface. 14 gigaparsecs away. It's basically emitted towards us, and we see it, but not before it's been lensed and scattered by intervening structure. And in particular, for this talk, there are galaxy clusters here, which have this 1,000,000 Kelvin gas, which I'll show as an image. What's the CMB? 10 million. Yes, thank you. Which here is your 10 million Kelvin gas. And it, what it does is it scatters and it creates a distortion. I won't bore you guys with pretty pictures of clusters too long. So here is delta T over T. So it creates a temperature distortion which is dependent on frequency in the sense that there is a turnover frequency. And this is the difference, delta I, in the intensity that you see at low frequencies. Low energy photons are upscattered away, and they're upscattered into this region. This is called a Y distortion. The amplitude of this shape, the shape doesn't change. What does change is its amplitude, which is measured by Y. And so what Planck has produced is a map in the sky of Y. And what that is nothing but the integrated number, the integrated temperature, basically, optical depth weighted, which is the pressure. So NE times T, if you like. And so in the direction of galaxy clusters, this is much higher, and you get this distortion, and it has that shape in frequency. So how do we simulate it? Well, we do a large region. So we do an 8 gigaparsec box that should be redshift 2. Is 5, so we're going out to about redshift 1.3, and we're putting a box here like that. And we're doing a realization, and for things that on the far side of the box, far from the center of the box that we're simulating, locally we treat it as the situation at an earlier time. Since we only use linear theory, it's quite easy to do that. So we make a catalog, and in fact we make many catalogs. And in each one of those, we had 4096 cube cells, which gives us a mass resolution in terms of halo mass of a few times 10 to the 13. So these are the most massive objects. They have this hot gas, electrons. If you go much below this, like if you asked, what's the Sunyav-Zeldovich effect from our galaxy at 10 to the 12, it's nothing, because there's no hot gas there. It's just not massive enough to cause a distortion. So we have that. So in each one of these realizations, we have sort of a sample of a mock universe. And then we put, this is a key part, is we put a pressure profile, which depends on the mass of the halo in the catalog and the redshift of the halo. And we paste it on as like spheres. Okay, so we paste on a galaxy cluster that is a spherical blob that has a centrally concentrated pressure that depends on its mass and its redshift. And we just paste them on and then we project it and we get the Y parameter everywhere in the sky. And we just do this a bunch of times for different random numbers. I don't know why that's, I think I hit. Okay, so that's the visual impression of it. You have some, so these were made by George Stein. So you have some realizations, you see, you just, in the roll of the dice, you just happen to have a cluster nearby. So you see there's a bright spot there, a bright spot there, so on and so forth. This is one region, and then I'll, I think I have enough time, so I'll show the movie. Okay, so the point is that each of these things is spherical. In, this is the spherical cow model of the SC. But sometimes they overlap. So this is, in fact, the largest halo we found in the whole volume, which is actually was not that close. This is for this. So another thing we can do with this is we can do statistics of the most extreme objects. We can say, what's the most massive object you see? What's the distribution of the most massive object you see? So real extreme tail statistics. Oftentimes you see discoveries of an object that's, you know, really massive, and does it challenge lambda CDM? What's, well, then you have to say, well, what's the distribution? So this kind of thing can also easily, or is suited well to do that. But what it's also suited well to do is go after something that's been difficult up until now. So the way clusters are used to constrain cosmology is by number, by counting them and saying, they're in a tail of a Gaussian distribution, and so if I change the overall amplitude of fluctuations a bit, I get a lot more clusters. It goes like the amplitude to the eighth power. And that's how they've been used. You just count them and you say, what does my theory predict? And then you put constraints on one of the six parameters, sigma 8, or the amplitude of the perturbations, A. And a way that's not used, which you might think, is to say, oh, let me calculate the correlation function of all these points. Let me just see how they're clustered. So the clustering of clusters, if you will, that traces out the perturbations. Why not do that? Well, the reason is because it turns out to be a hugely subdominant effect. So in other words, if I took this map and I just scrambled angle-wise all the positions of the halos in this map, I'd get a very similar power spectrum. So counting is as good as you can do. Unless you have more information, which is where these things are. So if I just gave you that map, you couldn't tell me sigma 8. But if I give you this map and I tell you, oh, by the way, there's a cluster there, 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 which you could probably figure out just by looking at the map, then you can say more. So to be more precise, if you just look at the power spectrum, that's not telling you as much. But if you find objects and then cross-correlate them, and that's the point that I'm coming to.
Well, I mean, the power spectrum, the Hassmann just learned that it depends, that it's typically dependent on sigma 8, half sigma 8 to the 8th power or something. So that could be also, if you understand everything else. Then
yes, and actually, so the number counts, I'm saying is, when we do understand enough to say what the power spectrum is, it will be equivalent to the number counts, because the one halo, it's just the one halo. Yeah, so the power spectrum will just move up and down. It's just DNDM, one halo. And you can see, I don't have it here, but I have separated it out, and I'll show you. So this is one run, here's the power spectrum. So what is being plotted here? This is the multipole L. This is small scales, large scales. Of this full map, this is the same sort of power spectrum you see for the CMB, but now I'm showing it for this Y parameter that you saw in the map. All of this shape is just a superposition of these spheres, one halo, not the clustering. In fact, if I were to scramble them, which unfortunately I don't have here, if I were just to scramble them and plot them again, it would kind of go like here, and then it would ever so slightly be a bit lower, and that would be your two halo. And when you, I'll show you the Planck data, has error bars like this, you don't know two halo from one halo if you just look at the power spectrum level. In fact, so this is five of them, a 25, and then 50. And so there's 500 of them that we did. And so this is still just a sample of, I think, 50 of them. And that now I'm putting the Planck data on it. I had to fudge. The point that this exact steep dependence on the cosmological parameter, in particular sigma 8, the amplitude of fluctuations, means that if I go back to the simulation and I do sigma 8 by 5%, it's going to change this by 40%. That's why it's a good, you know, measure. So what I want you to notice the agreement, and it's basically saying that that profile that we put in is a good profile, is the shape, okay? The shape doesn't change that much with parameters. It kind of goes up and down because the shape of the halos don't really change. And here we can put the same sort of 1 and 2 sigma contours. This is, it's kind of interesting. So if you see here, you see these Planck points are higher. And it is kind of true that you have more excursions if you look at the underlying statistics. But that's not exactly the point I wanted to make. I wanted to say that in addition to putting out this map, Planck has also put out a catalog of clusters. And for what they do is they go to the map and they fit to it, and it's pretty obvious sometimes when you look at it, you see the cluster there. It's a big hole at low frequencies. So you find each of these clusters and you go follow them up, do measurements, whatnot. For each one of them, you get a mass and a redshift. And this is from Planck 2015. This is their selection function, which means that it's very difficult because of foregrounds, they get small, the noise gets large. They can't really detect all these halos. This is mass and redshift. So in the simulation I showed you, we have all of these halos are here. This is about 1,500 halos. In one simulation, we have tens of millions of halos out to redshift 1.3. So we have many halos, and they're all creating this Y distortion. So we can do it. So this is what George Stein, the student at CETA, was making these plots. And it's just, you know, I'm just showing a few of them, but these are our clusters. So in this run, so some of those clusters that I showed you really close by would be a really massive one that would be really close. And just when you roll the dice, you get different clusters at different places. So, and here's the point of this whole thing, and the point I want to make is what happens if we take those correlated clusters, I mean, sorry, if we take those detected clusters and we correlate it and we mask out that part of the map, and then correlate those clusters with what's around it. Then what you will see is that there's a clustering of Y, of distortion, around those most massive objects. So we take these ones, which we know where they are, they're obvious, they're the big ones. So we take our map and we mask out where they are. Okay, and then we correlate. We put the ones that we detect in our simulation down, and then we cross-correlate it with the full map. And this is just for one case. This is the correlation coefficient. And even for one case, you see obviously that if I went to the Planck data now, I would predict that you would see this. And so it would be a detection of clustering of hot SZ gas in the existing Planck data. It just needs to be done, unless we are moving them way too much or they're way too biased or something. But there it is. So that's, this is the two halo term. You're picking it up by removing the Poisson. So clustering of groups and smaller clusters around clusters that we see is easily detectable, and I would argue that we should. So with that, I'm out of time, so I will just stop there. Thank you.
I have questions. So there has been this issue with matching the amplitude of Planck power spectrum, SC power spectrum with the models, and I didn't quite see it in what you were showing. Is this something that's gone away? Is it up there?
Yes. There is still a tension with the number counts that they give too small a power, and there are certain possibilities for that. So the tension is still there. It's been getting smaller and smaller.
The tension between number counts and the power spectrum?
The tension between the primary, and not the power, let's throw away the power spectrum, and let's just go with the number counts, which is the more solid one. The number counts and the primary CMB. So the primary CMB is giving a larger value than the number counts. And so those are at tension, but in the primary CMB, it's a linear thing. So, you know, this is you're trying to get at a parameter and you have to model the mass function. Okay, let's say we know that one. That one's not bad, but it's a pressure profile. How do you, and then that goes into galaxy cluster physics. What fraction of the energy, of the internal random energy associated with the object is in turbulence versus thermal energy? Because only the thermalized electrons contribute to this effect. There is some Y distortion caused by turbulent motions, but they're subdominant. And so there is, and magnetic fields as well, how much of clusters are held up. And so you can go and look at the most massive ones and actually see what they are and try to get the mass, but there's a mass observable relationship. And so it's probably in that.
You can calibrate that from, say, the weak lensing or the mass transducer.
Yes. That's right. So the lensing results, I think, if lensing also gives a small number. So that's the other interesting thing, is that you don't just see, you seem to see that lower redshift structure seems to want a lower amplitude than the CMB. That, but like I say, I think it's at the 1 or 2 sigma, but we can talk about it more. I'm not sure the latest on that.
So you listed some future directions there. Do you want to say a couple words?
Yeah, thank you. Let's see. So non-Gaussianity. So George Stein, the graduate student, has put in a local type FNL. There are these models that Dick Bond and collaborators are fond of that he calls intermittent. For example, you get splotches in field space, like cold spot. So do some sort of put that under the, that's the exotic. Cosmic infrared background, dusty galaxies, trace large scale structure. It's very difficult to get information out of that. You learn mostly about galaxies than you do about. But then there's this hydrogen and CO intensity mapping. So this CHIME is many of you know CHIME, or most of you. So we have a student who didn't do work for this, but is doing mocks, Phil Berger at CETA, and he's doing mocks to make intensity maps that are as a function of frequency by putting in H1 into the galaxies for CHIME, basically, as mocks for CHIME. And we want to publicly release it. So as soon as we get this SZ paper out, it should be coming out in time scale of weeks, then we'll clean it up and we'll release it, and then you can download it and make the light cones.
You had a name for this, right? I
forgot. Yeah, the name. So it's Peak Patches is the original Bond and Myers thing. That will be after we have to come up with a name.
So what is the name?
I don't know.
You don't have a name.
Tried not to say I didn't have a name. I'm really bad at coming up with names for codes, things, anything. So maybe we can chat about that, and I'll attribute.
Marcelo will be here for maybe two more. 24 hours, but just down the 401, an hour and a half away from here, on a good day.
I don't know about today.
So thanks, Marcelo.